Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Good evening, everyone. This is Ken McKean. Welcome you to Nature's Talk Show and tonight's Habitats of Nature. And my co-host Ken Borman will be joining me tonight, and we're going to take you on a really cool adventure. But before we get underway, we would like to ask that you please check out the Nature's Talk Show website, www.naturestalkshow. Ken is in the chat room, so you can go in there and join us on our chat as we check out life in a drop of water tonight. But before we get underway, Ken, you and Mary and Tom, I have a real exciting adventure coming up in just a few weeks. Uh-oh. Hope we didn't drop Ken. Well, while we wait for Ken to get back on here online, as I mentioned, go to the Nature's Talk Show and then join in the chat room. I know Ken's still probably in there. coming up here, Nature's Talk Show is really happy that we're going to be at the NEC conference coming up here in April. Nature's Talk Show is going to have a table there, and Ken and Mary Fetters and Tom Latz will all be available to chat with you and talk with you and talk about the show, and you probably even get some autographs from them. We are going Hello? To have some KLM artwork available. I hear somebody breathing. Somebody there?
Hello?
There he is. You're back.
All right.
All
okay.
Right.
I could hear you. You couldn't hear me that just then.
No, I just now you're back.
Yeah, you did a good job telling everyone what we're going to be doing in a couple of weeks.
yeah. And, a couple years ago, I was a guest speaker, the Friday night banquet speaker, as a matter of fact, at the NEC conference. And the people were wonderful. Everybody there treated me like a king. I just had a wonderful, wonderful time staying at the hotel. And I did the talk on the evolution of the freshwater fishes. It was presented for the first time. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time with the folks. The vendors, Ken, everything you want is going to be there, from marine fish to freshwater fishes. And here's the nice thing about the stuff like that for sale is that it's tank raised. And, you know what you're getting from the breeders themselves. That's really cool, Ken.
It is. It's very important, too. I'm very pleased to hear that, and I'm looking forward to being there. I am taking a small assortment of books along to sell, so if any of our listeners is going to the convention on the 8th to the 10th of April at Rocky Hill, Connecticut, drop me a note and just tell me if you'd like me to bring some books, and I'll certainly bring them. You're under no obligation to buy them, of course. Have a look at them. If you like them, you can buy them. I'll have good prices on them. But let me know what you want, just to make sure I can bring them along.
Yeah. And, Ken, you're also going to be in charge of raffle tickets. You and Mary and Tom will be raffling off some of my artwork to help support Nature's Talk Show there as well, so they can get some prehistoric reproductions of mine, along with some
raffle prizes to try and raise some money for the show. As you said, there's the prehistoric fishes, and there's some labyrinth fishes, some anabasids, and there's a penguin family.
Yeah, I did the penguin in honor of when we had, Diane.
Diane.
Yeah, we had
DiNapoli.
Diane DiNapoli on and talked about the penguins. So, at any rate, stop in and visit with Ken, Tom, and Mary, and you can get yourself some tickets, books, and all kinds of great stuff. And I wish I was going to be there. All right. Well, without further ado.
Right. I'm looking forward to it.
You'll have
a
great
time.
I'd
like to say hello to some of our listeners. So come on up and introduce yourself to me. I don't bite very hard, and it'll be fun.
Yeah. I had a great time I set myself up nice and comfortable, and ended up talking to a lot of people, you know, and met people I'd only read about on Facebook and, you know, talked with on Facebook. And of course, I also hung out with some of my old Killifish friends that I've known for nearly 40 years too. So, you know, you see everybody there. You're going to see everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So, at any rate, you know, Ken, probably one of the most, habitats that's totally neglected because it's nobody knows about it, nobody pays attention to it, and that's the microscopic habitats, you know, that live around us and are in the world all around us, don't you think?
I really think so, Ken. As you say, you just don't think about them. You see them. You see, particularly in the instance tonight, you see water everywhere, but you don't. Well, you do think about the life in there, but you don't think of the microscopic life in there, do you?
That's it, you know. And one of the things, as a little kid, I was always fascinated myself by nature, you know. And that's one of the curiosities I have. I always like to check things out, bodies of water and stuff, you know, and just see what was crawling around in it. I mean, it's really fascinating. And when I was in eighth grade taking science class, we were introduced to labs and how to do lab work. And one of the labs that we had was microscopic life. And I was able to look through a real microscope for the very, very first time. And, Ken, I was hooked. I mean, microscopic life is amazing. You know, I mean, this every time you put a drop of water on a slide, you know, you're looking at something alien to you, you know, just a total alien world.
I have got to agree with you there, Ken. It's been a few years since I've done it, but I can certainly remember doing it when I was just getting into aquariums and just putting that drop of aquarium water on the slide just to see what critters were in your fish tank. It's amazing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah, matter of fact, I've got a little bit of aquarium water here we'll talk about in a little bit here under one of my microscopes. I happen to have two type of microscopes. I have a nice dissecting microscope, and then I have a compound microscope. And mm-hmm. both of them are two of my favorite tools, you know. And personally, I don't know, I think the microscope is one of the greatest scientific tools ever invented. You know, we have the telescope, which is a fantastic tool. I mean, it allows us to see so far and deep into space, you know, and then when you look at the microscope, you know, you're seeing the other opposite direction, you know, you're seeing things that are too small for your eye to see, you know, and the world is amazing. I'm always, you know, just fascinated every time that I've looked at. And it's different kinds of water too, Ken. Every time you look at some of these, like just a common mud puddle
mm-hmm.
that holds water for, like, say, you know, 2 or 3 weeks after a rain, you know, and you see the algae developing in it and stuff, and you know, the different things like that, microscopic life. And within that short period of time, this pool of water will have a whole ecosystem that develops. But you can only see it with a microscope. That's amazing.
It certainly is. Actually, we should tell our listeners too, I'm sorry about that, that the microscope most of them would be thinking about when we talk about microscopes would be a compound microscope, wouldn't it?
Yes, I believe so. And that's the one for the best viewing, although I have to admit a dissecting microscope also has its point, too. That's a lot of fun because with a compound microscope, usually you use a slide with a slide cover, and that puts the organisms in a really small, you know, realm. They don't have a lot of room to maneuver around, but these little creatures are so small that in that drop of water under a slide, there's enough room for them to move, you know, live their lives. They're so tiny, they don't even know they're on a slide.
That's right. And there's certainly, in a drop of water, there's certainly more than one in a lot of instances, isn't there?
It's amazing how crowded some waters can be. I've had raised cultured paramecium back in high school, and you'll watch the water turn milky white with millions of paramecium in a quart jar. For our listeners out there, if you want to experiment with raising paramecium, it's so simple. You take a jar, put a bunch of grass clippings in it, and fill it up with water and set it in a kind of a semi-sunny spot where it'll get a little bit of sun. Not a lot, but just enough to help the algae grow in it, too. And natural spores of these different creatures that are floating around in the air will usually, if they're not already settled on the grass when you put it in, will settle out into the water and revive themselves. And it's really fascinating to watch this happen.
And of course, we do that to feed our fry, don't we?
Absolutely. That's one of the things for those of us who have raised some of the smallest fishes in the world. One of the first foods you can give these little fish are paramecium. Now, this is cool about paramecium, Ken, is they're towards the small end of what the human eye can see, okay?
Yeah.
Excuse me. And when you look in an aquarium or a piece of jar of water, I hate that little frog that pops up about this time of night. But anyway,
it always does, doesn't it, unfortunately?
Yeah, well, for our listeners, I do have asthma, and it can be a problem sometime. But anyway, when you're when you hold up the jar of water, though, it's really cool when you can see the paramecium, but you can also see worms, little teeny tiny worms, you know, little small crustaceans. I think we talked not too long ago about copepods, I think, in temporary pools.
Yep. Yeah.
And some of these copepods that you will find are so small that they're almost only visible under the microscope. I've seen some species where, you know, you think they would be just larvae of other a larger species, but no, they're fully grown, about half the size of some of the, and we're talking tiny, Ken. We're talking quarter millimeter in length, you know, stuff, and smaller.
That is awfully small.
Yeah, getting down to micron size, too, you know, we're talking, you know, so we're talking some tiny, tiny creatures, you know. And, but I remember,
the discovery of the microscope, no one knew that all these little creatures existed, did they?
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, nobody knew they were there, you know, this this whole world. And it's interesting because the evidence of the compound microscope seems to have been invented in the Netherlands back in the 1600s. A gentleman named Cornelius Drebbel is given kind of thought to be one of the earlier inventors. Then there's also Hans Lippershey, who also supposedly invented one of the first microscopes, and he also was one of the first people to obtain a patent on a telescope. So there's some other people too, but at any rate, there was it was an early invention back in the 1620s, thereabouts, the early 1600s, and can you imagine the wonder of these first people when they're starting to look and see these small things, you know?
It'll be just as fantastic as looking at the heavens through a telescope for the first time. All of a sudden, you realize that what you see with the naked eye just doesn't really cut it, does it?
You know, it's amazing. And they say Galileo's telescope was probably about as powerful as a powerful set of binoculars, you know. And I've looked at the Jupiter system with a powerful set of binoculars, Ken. You can see the four moons orbiting around it, you know, and it's amazing. And I've also stuck a 1200 millimeter focal length telescope on it too. So
Yeah, it makes a difference, doesn't it?
Oh, then it gets really incredible when you're seeing the bands and the great eye spot, et cetera. You know, it's really amazing. But that's a wonder and so on. And we'll have to have a talk about that Wednesdays on Nature's Talk Show, because
mm-hmm.
I love astronomy, and it's one form of science that is part of nature, very much a part of nature. We'll have to talk about that. But when we get back to this here, the invention of the microscope, I think Robert Hooke was one of the first people that really started studying small animals, and I believe he wrote a book called Micrographia, and he drew these creatures and these small organisms, and it actually started the beginning of the biological structure or biological analysis.
Well, it had to start somewhere, and without that start, we wouldn't be anywhere near as advanced as we are now, would we?
No. These are the people, that I do tip my hat to, because all these people we've talked about over the years on the show here, these scientists, they have set the foundation for what we know today, and the instruments we use today, the microscopes we use today are so far advanced, over these guys. It's like their microscope is advanced over the naked eye, and we're using, electron microscopes and microscopes that they can even get down into where we can peer into the atoms themselves. So we're really, and that's fascinating, isn't it? We're able to actually see the atomic structure.
It is, and I can only imagine what we'll be able to do in another couple of hundred years.
Exactly. But let's go back here, though, for our listeners, though, for those who want to explore these amazing things. And one of the greatest contributors here, I wanted to mention also to microscopy was Antoni van Leeuwenhoek. And he actually was the one that discovered red blood cells and spermatozoa. And that helped popularize microscopy as a technique because we could look at parts of our body and understand them better.
It all contributed to our general pool of knowledge, didn't it?
Yeah, and their first microscopes were pretty simple, and Robert Hooke, I think he might have been one of the first people that started putting the microscope, in a more familiar form. I've seen photographs of his or drawings of his microscope, and it looks a little bit more modern than the original one that Leeuwenhoek was using, which was where you kind of held up a little thing to the light, a little lens. I think he might even use a drop of water on the earliest microscope like that.
Could well have.
Yeah.
Would make sense, actually.
Yeah, but they discovered how glass could be polished and helped how it bends light, too, So that's one of the really beautiful, amazing properties, about glass. It's, can be made into these giant lenses and mirrors and helps us with our microscope research and astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the coolest things I remember, Ken, back in the day, and I actually helped a science teacher of mine. He was doing a study, and this is with the microscope what he was doing, but he was studying the algae species, single-celled algae, of the Ohio River.
Wow. I would imagine that there could be a considerable number of different ones there.
That there was, and what I did was he had me, what I was, at the time, sometimes it's cool to be a nerd. I think it was something cool. I got to, between 8th and 9th grades, I got to go to a special summer class for the scientifically gifted. and it was to help us learn scientific method by ninth grade. You know, so that's how far back my scientific method instruction goes. It goes way back.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the things I got to do was hang out with one of my middle school science teachers. He was doing a doctorate thesis, or I believe, or I forget which one he was working on. But anyway, he was doing this research, and what I got to do to hang out with him was I would on his papers is I would draw each just a pencil drawing of each algae species. There was a number of them, and it was really fun, you know, drawing these species. I think there was like Cenodesmus and Kystrodesmus, Pediastrum, and there was a couple others that he was looking for. And I think, but I remember drawing these little algaes up, you know, their shape, and he would write down how many he would see in the microscope. And what he was doing was really interesting with the microscope. Was he was the slides he used had a micron grid laid out on them, and he would count how many of these different algaes were on the grids, and that's how he was seeing which algae species was the most dominant.
Wow. And
now, what was fun at the same time, they had the room had microscopes in it. And when he was there, I got to go in, and after I got done doing a bunch of papers for him, I could take in water samples or whatever, and I would play around for a couple hours looking through the microscope and studying all kinds of things, you know, just...
That would have been a blast. That would have been so much fun.
Yeah.
What else other than the algae cells did you find when you were looking through at the sample scan?
Well, what I really enjoyed, I believe that was the first, well, for the most part, probably the most common critter we got to see was ciliates. And those are animals that move around like with little tiny hairs called cilia. A paramecium is a real, real good example of a ciliate. Now, the interesting, excuse me, there's that cough again. But the interesting thing about some of these ciliates is paramecium, as I mentioned, you know, it can be seen with the naked eye if you look really, really close. And some of these other little ciliates that you'd see swimming around were about the size of the organelles inside a paramecium itself. And that was, you know, amazing to see the size difference. You know, between these little organisms, and their structure was laid out the same, you know, inside their cells. So, we would see those. And another creature that was fairly common, especially you'd see them attached to stems of algae or piece of algae or piece of debris, and that was a little creature called Vorticella. And Vorticellas were neat. Another name for them was the Bell Animalcule. And these little guys had a little bell-shaped kind of a body that had a ring of cilia around it that fed directed towards a central mouth area. And these animals, now what they feed on is bacteria, small debris and bacteria and organic matter. And they would sweep these the debris or bacteria or whatever into their feeding cavity and little food vacuole would form around these little things and go off into the body to be digested. And, you know, it was really cool to see us lay out on both of these, you know. But anyway, another interesting thing about Vorticella is it had a little stalk, and if it was disturbed by something, it would contract, and just like a little coiled spring. And then as the animal, I guess, felt the danger pass, it would slowly extend back out and start feeding again. And sometimes you see clusters of them, and there was another species that appeared to be related to it, except it seemed to live in colonies, you know. And it was, you know, like I said, these were really cool to see these, you know, these different animals like that. Another very, very common creature that was really cool to see. And that's an animal called Stentor, sometimes called the trumpet animalcule. And sometimes you'd see thousands of them in a body of water. And
I can't say as I know that one, Ken. What can you tell us about that one?
Well, it's once again, it's another little ciliate. Now, it has an interesting thing about it, is it not only does it have a shape, like I said, it looks kind of like a trumpet, has the cilia around the bell of the trumpet, but sometimes it moves around and not quite amoeba-like, but it doesn't have a full-on stentor shape. And it'll move around like that. And sometimes it just releases its little holdfast at the, I guess you could say, the small end of the trumpet. And but it has a little foot-like body that helps it hold it in place. Now, once again, this is a single-celled animal. And it's cool to watch it move around, because when it's moving around, it's swimming, so to speak, its body does a cool little rotation because of the shape of it. It makes it spiral through the water. Same way with a paramecium.
Well, I guess we should say, too, with all these very tiny little creatures we're talking about, do they all use asexual reproduction, like splitting, like an amoeba will? Or
this is kind of...
is there sexual reproduction in something that small?
Now you're gonna think this is pretty cool. Paramecium is a really killer animal. It can split, divide in two, but also there are times that two paramecium will share genetic material with each other, a sexual reproduction, if you will. They don't share sperm or an egg, but they will share actual genetic material with each other, and then they'll divide.
Wow, that is pretty amazing, actually. Who knew?
Yeah, I think at that small, that's about as close as you're going to come to a sexual reproduction in that kind of an organism. But now, the amoeba, you know, the cool thing about amoebas is amoebas actually belong to a larger group than most people believe. Have you ever heard of an organism called a radiolarian?
Yes, I have, actually. I've studied some early German works on very small animals, and I have seen a whole page on radiolarians there. They're cool, but what can you tell our listeners about them, Ken?
You know, they are very cool. Well, basically what it is, it's, and this is what's cool about some of the amoebas. It's, they built shells. You know, the common amoeba, I forget the scientific name of it, but, you know, you see it crawling around in an amorphous blob, you know, with its pseudopods as it crawls around. And the first time I saw one of them, it was really cool watching it move. But a lot of these, like a radiolarian, they build a test, and these little amoebas, they would send out these little tiny strands of protoplasm from these little tiny holes in the test, you know, and foraminiferous were another type of amoeba type of organism that built a shell. They were kind of rice grain shaped, and sometimes they even looked like little teeny, tiny, microscopic-sized ammonites or nautiloids, but they're microscopic one-celled animals. And these organisms lived in these shells. And I think it's fascinating that we look at these one-celled animals, you know, knowing that they were some of the first organisms to actually build a shell for protection.
That is pretty amazing, actually. It just came to me as to the gentleman's work, who I really am interested in, and that's Haeckel.
Haeckel,
the early German.
He did a lot of work with some of that small stuff, didn't he?
Microscopy, and showing all the people of the time the incredible amount of life that you could find in a drop of water, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, and like I said, once you start exploring, you know, it's just amazing. Now, we've talked, let's see, another group of organisms that's really fascinating and sometimes can be fairly common. And those are an organism called Euglena. Now, you've heard of Euglena, I believe, haven't you?
Yes, we had to study them at school.
Yeah. I was one of my little study organisms, too. You know, an organism that has chlorophyll, but also moves like an animal.
And I can remember drawing those things. I could never get the sinuous body shape right, but I got a pretty good approximation to it at the end.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. For listeners out there, there's a when you're looking through a microscope and drawing details, there's a cool way to do it. I was taught to use my left eye to peer through the microscope. With my right eye, I could draw the picture of it at the same time. Did you learn that?
No, I was never privy to that information. It might have helped me, actually.
Yeah. That's what we were taught that in ninth grade, actually. And it was really interesting, you know, because you will be amazed that you can look with your left eye through the microscope at the creature, and at the same time your right eye is looking at that little piece of paper, and you're drawing mm-hmm. what you're looking at through the microscope.
Yes, that would make it a lot easier. I don't know why I wouldn't have thought of doing that anyway, but I didn't.
Yeah.
I would just look at whatever I was looking at and then go to the paper and try and draw it from memory.
Yeah, that's one of the nice things I liked about my biology teacher. We were, you know, she did teach us that. And some of us were good at it. I was able to do it really easily. Then, of course, there's others that just could not get that eyeball coordination, you know, down. But,
yep, it's, you either have it or you don't.
Yeah. It seems to be like that when you're finding bone in the field, you know. It's like Dr. Lucas said, some people can see the bone, others just, they can be looking right at it, and they cannot see a piece of bone laying there looking, you know, staring up, right up at
right.
it,
yeah.
You know. And it's kind of fascinating about that, you know. But the Euglenas are an interesting little organism. Now, one of the things I found about them is they have a little eyeball thing, not a true eye, though, but a little eye spot, and I think it helps them to move towards the light.
Yes, I always found that they did swim towards a light source, I thought. So, and that's why they're good for feeding fry, isn't it? Because they stay at the top of the water column where the fry would be. So if you know all these little things, you can pick which foods would be best for the fry.
For those of us who have been in the aquarium world for a long time, we know green water is one of the most awesome soups to put your baby fish in. Yeah, if you got teeny tiny fry hatching out or whatever, feed them green water first, and that includes Euglenas. They're a real good source. Plus, there's other a few other organisms too that pop up like that. So, yeah, that's one nice thing about understanding the microscopic world when you're working with some of these small fish. You know, some of these creatures that I'm talking about now, the best. I think, Ken, here real quick, we should mention what a power, you know, should you look at some of this stuff, and, you know, what magnification. With a mm-hmm. compound microscope, I like 100X. It's beautiful size. It blows paramecium and most small, almost every single-celled protist that I guess you could call them, is visible. When you start going for things like bacteria, this is where you start having to use the higher powers. And my microscope goes up to 1,000 power. Now, 1,000 magnification. Yeah. But you have problems with that, too. It's because glass has some interesting properties, is that it actually slows down light. Did you know that? Light slows down when it hits glass. The speed of light.
I didn't know that. There you go.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that gives it a refractive property, you know, because when light hits it, it does. It slows down. Then it speeds back up as soon as it gets through the silica. And I find that amazing. That's why thicker glass lenses, they say, you know, it reduces the light. And they're right, because it does, light has to go through that. Even though it's translucent, it's not translucent to what wavelengths of light. They still bounce off the atoms.
Right.
Fascinating stuff, isn't it?
It is, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, knowing how the eye works and how microscopes and stuff, you know, it is kind of amazing when you see how this, you know, we're able to see this stuff. And but there's now with 100x on your compound microscope, you don't have to use anything to help out with this problem I was just explaining, because when you go to 1000x, usually what you have to do is something called oil immersion. Have you ever heard that?
I'm not aware of that term.
Okay. What that is you have to have a clear path between your slide and your first objective with for the light to travel through. And what you do is you usually put oil, a film of oil, and that's what you immerse the lens in when you're working with really, really high powers. And that oil helps the light with its, I guess, helps with the magnification, you know, helps enhance the image. So
I've never worked with anything very much higher than 100x. That's probably why I've never encountered this problem before.
Yeah, and but that's what you have to go. And this is what's amazing when you think about this with a microscope, you know, is the bacteria are so small that 1000x, you know, just starts bringing them into where they can be observed on many of these small species. Isn't that amazing? Look how tiny that is, you know?
It is. It's awesomely small. But then I guess if you're at 1000 and you had a Euglena swim past, that would occlude everything, wouldn't it? It'd be like
it'd be a whale across your view screen there. Yeah,
I guess it would be like an eclipse.
Eclipse
the light, the available light at that size.
Yeah, these animals are so much larger, you know, like I said, a Euglena, than these bacteria. You know, thousands of bacteria to make the length of one Euglena. We're talking tiny, tiny, tiny creatures. And some of these creatures, you know, they're just some of the packs small enough to house life. And that's really amazing, you know, when you're looking at some of this bacteria like that. And we'll be talking about that on our next habitats when you and I go visit the extremophiles and the extreme habitats.
Yeah, that should be another good show. Again, another microscopic world opens up, doesn't it?
And this one we're going to talk about really small stuff, nano dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, but other interesting creatures that pop up occasionally. Well, you know, one of the cool things, too, is, as we mentioned earlier, you know, I was drawing all these algaes. And here's something cool, too, Ken. I was talking earlier about, for our listeners here, I actually do have a sample of aquarium water here with a microscope set up, and I can actually identify some really interesting things happening here. There's aquarium plants in it, and one of the stems there, you can see the cells in the leaves. But growing on the stem are all these little green specks, and these green specks are one-celled algae. And occasionally, you'll see where they're growing. And Ken, I've identified the species of algae. It's a Droponardalia.
Droponardalia. That's incredible that you can get right down and identify algae.
Yeah, I can. But that's the genus I'm looking at right now, and it's a filamentous type of algae. And what's really cool about it is out of these little cells, it has these little tufts that grow out of them, and that sets it off as unique. And that's one of the things that has helped me identify this particular species of algae. Now, I haven't come across any paramecians or anything like that. And there's another creature that I'm surprised is missing out of this aquarium water sample, Ken, and that's rotifers.
Yeah, they're quite prevalent, usually, aren't they?
But rotifers are again, everywhere.
The edification of our listeners, didn't you say that that sample was from a tank that hasn't been in use for a while?
Yeah, this tank here has not had any fish in it probably for 2.5 years, yeah.
Wow.
Just water plants.
I wonder if that would explain the absence of some of the things that you expected to find in there.
It could. Now, this is also from an upper sample towards the top of the tank. I did not get down into the lower levels. But for our listeners, rotifers are very interesting little animals. I believe they're supposed to be related to the worms. But they have a... they're found in all kinds of waters. They're very tiny. Most are microscopic, and they're sometimes... Now, this is what's cool about them, Ken. The first time I saw a rotifer, I thought it was a one-celled animal. But they're not. They're multi-celled animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very small multi-celled animals, but they are, aren't they?
That they are. And what's really cool is you can count the number of cells in one of these things.
Actually, isn't it rotifers that, the shells of rotifers that is diatomaceous earth? Is that right?
No, actually, that's diatoms.
Diatoms, that's right.
Diatoms, yeah. And we'll have to talk about diatoms, because diatoms under the microscope are very, very, very cool. They have some interesting properties. But the rotifers, now, once again, you and I being fish breeders, rotifers are one of our best friends.
Not too much about them, really.
Well, they're one of the neatest little, they're small, microscopic, of course, about the size of a paramecium, some of them. And fish fry, especially small ones, chow down on these guys. I know I'm having going to have some good fry when I know I have rotifers in the tank. And the two most common species of rotifer that I've got to see is Philodina roseola. That's a elongate type of rotifer that's got several segments. It's got a large stomach area towards the head end. It has double rows of cilia. They give the animal their common name. They've got little wheels twirling. And the foot can attach or detach from the substrate, and they swim around with their cilia. And they're fairly flexible. They're one of the larger ones. Then there's one called the Monostyla lunaris is another one I've seen. It has a little round test with a little tiny tail pointed tail coming out the back of it. And but those are the two most common. But there's several other kinds. There's one called Floscularia rigens, and they actually build a series of tubes that are joined together, and they branch off from each other.
I can only recommend to our listeners, if you get a chance to have a look through a microscope, grab yourself a drop of aquarium water and do it. You'll be blown away by what you see, what they can.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And get different kinds of water. Get you a sample of river water. Get a sample of a lake water. Get a sample of pond water. Get a sample of a mud puddle. You know, because each of these areas have different, they have different stuff growing. They have different habitats. You'll see just so many other species. And for someone, I almost wish, Ken, years ago, I'd made a record of everything I've seen under the microscope, and I wish I'd went out of my way to try to find animals, to go out and...
Right.
Because I do that with birds and things.
It's surprising. You don't really see it unless you consciously do so, unless you've got that innate ability to find bone, as you said before, or something similar. But it is amazing. And when you think about what you see... Too, I find it's pretty amazing that you can understand life processes a lot better when you realize that green water that all the fish rely on to reproduce in and actually eat is in itself a little world that's got its own creatures, that are predated upon by these tiny, tiny little fry. So for everything, there is something smaller all the way through, isn't it?
It goes down to about the tiniest bit of matter that can contain life. I mean, it's really amazing, you know, when you look at the smallest.
All these things we're talking about, you gleaners and that, they have to eat too, don't they?
Yeah, and they feed on... Now, the nice thing about Euglena having the chloroplast is it manufactures its own food, but when you look at paramecium, it's really fascinating watching them feed, you know, because they'll sit there and they'll, especially when they find a food source, like a you know something with a lot of bacteria around it, you'll just watch them just back and forth up to it, you know, as they filter in these little bacteria. And it's fascinating, you know, to see these things grazing. And like I said, you know, this isn't just a drop of water. Other creatures that pop up in these drops of water, you know, that you normally wouldn't think about seeing. There's myriad little worms. One of the most common little worms, and these guys are giants when you look at them under the microscope. I mean, it might be five or six times the length of a paramecium or even bigger. That's the Ilosoma worms. And they're kind of interesting because they're fairly clear, but they've got little tiny red and yellow pigment spots all across their body and little hairs. But they're a little tiny worm that's, believe it or not, in the earthworm group.
Wow.
Now, these guys,
where do you find them, Ken?
A lot of times in your aquarium.
Where would you expect to find them? What kind of water?
Any fresh water.
Any fresh water at all?
Yeah,
I've probably
any fresh
seen
water.
Them and not realized what I was looking at in that case.
Look on your aquarium glass or the magnifying glass, and I'll bet you'll see these guys.
All right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Use a magnifying glass, but you can see them with the naked eye. But they're teeny tiny little worms.
I expect too that if you were a saltwater keeper and you looked at saltwater through a microscope, you'd see a whole new set of animals. And plants, too, wouldn't you?
I wish I'd had a microscope at the time. I had my one marine tank back in Indiana years ago. I had a saltwater tank I had set up, kept a couple groupers and lionfish. And what was cool, Ken, is I had marine copepods living in it.
Oh, that would have been great.
Yeah. Oh, I used to think back then, it's like, because... This was in the 70s, and nobody in aquariums or marine world was even thinking halfway about breeding anything. It was just like, yeah, breed something from the saltwater world. You're crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it
now, that
was
would
not
have been
new.
Really good. Incredible to have, as you said, if you could have only thought to have a look at the time, it would have been great.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, any of our listeners that live along beach areas, go get you some water samples from that. Get on our website and post some of the stuff you see on our chat room. That'd be really, really awesome because there's some really, really cool stuff. Now, you mentioned earlier diatomaceous earth and diatoms.
Yep.
And diatoms are really cool because they're an interesting organism that was thought to be like an algae once, but it seems that they're on their own little group because they have two shells. This is what's cool about diatoms, Ken. They have a top and bottom shell that fit interlock into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And where the little shells meet up, overlap, that's where a band of protoplasm actually moves these diatoms around. And
wow.
Some live singly, and some live in colonies, chains and stuff. But they all have small pores in them, and these pores are so small that they can be used to filter water. And the filtration that they do is really, we're talking just barely a few microns across. They filter out almost every bacteria that's in the water like that. You know, just really amazing stuff. But
I can remember back in the day, there used to be a filter that you used to get to polish your water. And it used diatomaceous earth as the filter medium. And
I still have one.
This thing, it was incredible. It really cleaned that water. There was not a particle could be seen in that water once it had filtered through that diatomaceous earth filter.
Yeah, when I had my one of my aquarium shops back east, my rare and unusual aquarium shop, I loved my diatom filters. I had several of them I used. Kept that water good and clean, you know.
It was spotless, wasn't it?
Yeah. Now here's the interesting good thing about a diatom filter is it would remove parasites, microscopic parasites like ick, out of your water.
Mm.
But it would remove everything too. it would filter out all the bad, you know. It would clean that water up. It, like I said, it would polish it really good. You didn't want to use it to raising babies because it would take all the goodies out. But if you wanted to clean up a tank really well, especially a display tank, it was the best. I loved it for display tanks. You know. Now,
you couldn't beat that one, could you? Once you did your gravel cleaning and everything, and then you ran it through the diatomaceous earth filter, it was spotless.
It was spotless, yeah. The interesting thing, water going in might have bacteria and critters in it, but water coming out did not. And
that's right.
But it was utilized those little microscopic pores that you find in diatoms. Now, another interesting thing about diatoms, too, back in the early days of microscopes, diatoms and radiolarians, but they used to use them and set up these slides where they put ranged diatoms and to be viewed under the microscope. Isn't that pretty wild?
It is, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was like a to see who could do the best of these, you know, who was the best person at doing these. But this is quite common back in the, I guess, among microscope people, nerds, back in the 1800s. I believe that's when they did
that. Too, is if you've got diatoms in your earth, in your aquarium, it appears as like a what we call brown algae is actually diatoms, isn't it?
Yeah. And diatoms are one of those things that will pop up, especially in your outdoor samplings. And as I mentioned, there's many different forms. A diatom called Navicula. Excuse me, Navicula. It looks like a elongate football, kind of. Another one like Fragilaria. Capucina, it grows in these long chains of plates. Cymbella lancelata has a very interesting shape. It's almost like a curved cigar, you know. But there's many, many, many forms of these diatoms. It's I've got just you know thousands and thousands of species, and they're very, very common.
Just too small to be seen.
Yeah, just too small to be seen. But they make a big influence, too, because they also help feed the bottom of the food chains, the microscopic algae.
We'd be lost without all these creatures that we're talking about.
Exactly.
Because, they are, as you say, they are the basis of every food chain on the planet.
Yeah. You know, and I don't know how rich, you know, I couldn't imagine how poor my life would have been without being introduced to the microscope back when I was a kid. You know, Ken?
It certainly does help scientific approach, doesn't it?
Well, there's, and like I said, when you look at the world and you understand all the way from the microscope up to the telescope, you know, what you're looking at, to me, it not only does it help me in my understanding of my paleontology, you know, but it helps me understand, you know, whatever's everything is going around in the world. You know, why everything from, you know, why the weather works to why volcanoes happen, you know, to how, you know, life in a drop of water works. It's all, you know, it's interconnected because we're roaring around this galaxy, you know, at 100,000 miles an hour. We're not stable. We're not steady. We're moving. That's one of the things I think a lot of people need to remember, you know. Everything looks like it's so stable. But it's not, you know. We're on an amazing adventure as we continue. You know, life continues, you know, on this earth.
Yeah, maybe more people should take the time to have a look through a microscope, and it actually does broaden your mind, doesn't it? When you realize that, like a lot of the naysayers might change their minds if they look through a microscope at a drop of water, and just see the ultimate, all the life that is around there.
It's astounding, and not only the small life, but look at some of the creatures. I don't know how many of our listeners out there have ever had the opportunity to see a fish embryo under a microscope, like a dissecting microscope, and look and watch its heart beating, watch its gills, see its eyes, see these things, or even see a fish egg that's just been fertilized. You're just seeing the cells in the first stages of development. These things with the microscope that opens up, it's just such an amazing, amazing world that I don't know how to stress it, enough to say, I've turned my microscope off now because you got to take care of these things, and we'll have to take a real quick moment here and tell about that real quick, Ken. I noticed the show went real fast.
It's been good, actually.
Yeah, fun stuff, But these habitats are out there. And but real quick here, let me go over some microscope techniques here I want to tell our listeners, because I recommend for anybody that's science-minded, get a microscope. Go out and buy you a dissecting scope or a compound microscope and look at stuff. Take a little bit of time once a week or two and go out and just check what's crawling around. The dissecting scope, looking at insects and things like that, Ken, has just been such a wonderful thing. But you got to take care of these things. I take care of my microscope like it's the high-precision tool that it is. Each one cost me several hundred dollars a piece. I did not go out and buy cheap microscopes. Don't go buy the kiddie microscopes you see for sale at Walmart or whatever. These things have plastic lenses. Plastic lenses are the worst kind of thing to use for optics, for any kind of thing. Throw plastic lenses away, unless you're playing with a toy. Get a good glass lens microscope. When you're carrying the microscope, always use two hands, one on the back of it, one underneath it, so you don't drop it. These things are very... very delicate.
I can remember those lessons from school.
yeah. When you're done with it, wipe it off and put the dust covers back on it. Always cover your microscope. My microscope never, never goes without the cover once I'm done with it. Put it back in its place where it's a safe place. It can't get bumped, knocked off, or anything to happen to it. I keep mine up on a high shelf here in my office. And they're right where I can get them, but they're also out of the way where they won't get knocked around because they're fun. And enjoy the microscope world. Just pick stuff up, explore, because there's so many cool things. Look at nanocrystals under a microscope. Go get you some little glinty crystally rocks and see how big the crystals grow and what they look like that. Look at leaves. Look at anything under a microscope, and you'll be amazed. Ken, I don't know what else to say other than... It's been a fantastic thing with a microscope.
It has, and it really will open your eyes to all the infinite number of worlds that are out there that you don't think about.
Yeah.
Unless you think like a microscope to look through.
Well, I want to thank my teachers back when I was in middle school and high school. I had several teachers that were really instrumental in my seeking an art and science career. And without their encouragement, I would not be a well-known artist or working for a museum of natural history. So I have these teachers to thank, because they were instrumental in encouraging me. And I'm so glad they did, because it's been a wonderful, wonderful trip studying, nature.
Yep. You, without that grounding, you're lost, aren't you? You certainly do need it.
You need it all.
I hope that's inspired all our listeners to grab a microscope and look at that drop of water.
You'll be glad you did.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, real quick here, we're at the top of the hour. We do want to let our listeners know that tomorrow night on the Fine Art of Paleontology, you and I are going to be playing around in the Permian once again, but we're going to be doing a nice section of the Permian Sea called the Great Capitan Reef System of southeastern New Mexico and southwestern Texas. It's or the biggest fantastic.
Well, I'm looking forward to that. I don't really know all that much about that formation, so it'll be interesting. It'll be a good show.
It's going to be fun, and it's where down by Carlsbad, New Mexico, for our listeners, and Carlsbad Caverns goes right through the heart of the great Capitan Reef of the Permian period, and we'll be talking about what's fantastic. We have all kinds of knowledge to talk about it, so it's going to be fun. And also on Biohabitats next time, Ken and I are going to take you into the nano world of the thermophiles and the extreme habitats here on Earth. And we might even delve into space by exploring whether extremophiles could represent life on other worlds, too. So that's going to be a fun one there, Ken.
It should be a great show, and I'm looking forward to doing that one.
Yeah, we got some great stuff. And also coming up on the green scene, you and I are going to be talking about grass and lawns. And that's going to be a fun show, too.
Yep, we just got to work out when we're going to do that, and we'll get it scheduled and let all your listeners know when that one's coming up.
Yeah, I think next Sunday might be the date for that one.
Well, we can certainly do that.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting one because I, over the years, Ken, back when I was young, I used to mow lawns. I used to even make lawns, convert a weed field into a grassy lawn, you know. So we can talk about that'd be fun talking about lawns and where they do they belong in society more. Or what, you know?
Yep, it'll be a great discussion, I'm sure.
All right. Well, before we go, Ken, you and Mary and Tom are going to be at the NEC conference. We want to remind our listeners about you guys being there so you can talk and say hi and everything.
That's right. If you're in the New England area and you want a great time and you're there between April 8th to the 10th, that's when the NEC conference is on at Rocky Hill, Connecticut. Come along, you'll learn lots and lots about fish, and we'll be there in the vendor and manufacturer hall. Come up and say hi, tell us that you listen to the show, and tell us what your favorite show is. If you've got any ideas on future shows, let us know so we can pull them together for you. As I say, at the convention there's always great speakers, there's always room sales, there's always vendor sales. We're going to be raffling off some of Ken McKeegan's paintings. So come along, buy a ticket, support the show, and it'll be just a fun weekend.
And the people there are wonderful too, so it's well worth the trip.
I've known a lot of them for a while. Some face to face, some I've only ever conversed with on, you know, through the computer and on the phone. I'm looking forward to meeting everyone, some for the first time, and as you say, always you renew our friendships at any of these conventions too, don't you?
Yeah, and I had the pleasure when I was a guest speaker a couple years ago, actually attending a killifish meeting for the one of the groups there too, my killifish buddies. So I was their long distance member. Since I'm from New Mexico, I was a foreign member, our foreign visitor. All right.
Well,
again,
I was for that.
Yeah,
and
well.
And I'm living in Canada, I'm certainly foreign.
Well, for American listeners out there, New Mexico is part of the United States. We are not part of Mexico.
It's Mexico,
Canada. It's amazing. We're the only state that has USA on their plates to remind people. We are, yeah. So, anyway, well,
so
our listeners, we want to thank everybody for joining us tonight, Ken.
In deference to your country, I will refrain.
Have fun, man. When we get there, we're going to have fun. I don't refrain. All right. Well, anyway. For our listeners, everyone, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. We've had a wonderful time talking about the microscopic world. And join us tomorrow night here on Fine Art of Paleontology because Ken and I are going to talk about some really incredible stuff tomorrow, too. So see you here next time on Nature's Talk Show. Good night, everybody.
Good night from me.
Join us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.